Good afternoon and welcome to the March meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from the summit of Point Lookout in Northport on the coast of Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord and I'm the president of the board of the forum. Since 1985, we've been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of foreign service, journalism, or academia talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs and other information is available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The Midcoast Forum today is lucky to have with us retired Colonel Bill Smullen, who is director of the Maxwell School's National Security Studies Program at Syracuse University. Until 2002, he was chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, with whom he had worked for nearly 13 years, first as special assistant when Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and then later as Powell's chief of staff at America's Promise, the Alliance for Youth, a nonprofit organization chaired by Powell. Smullen also served as special assistant to Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral William Crow, before retiring from the Army in 1993. He earned a BA in Business and Economics from the University of Maine in 1962. But the most important thing about Bill's bio is that he's a local Mainer. He grew up in Camden and graduated from Camden High School. And I'm grateful for one of his And I'm particularly grateful to one of his lifelong Camden friends, Don Morrison. Where is Don? Oh, Don Morrison, who was extremely helpful in getting Bill to come up here. So let's have another round of applause for a great Mainer who we're delighted to have here.
Thank you, Mac, for that very kind introduction, and thank you for the invitation to speak to the Maine Coast Forum, and I congratulate those of you who are members of this forum or who seek the opportunity to hear speakers who come to this forum. I think the one thing that's probably lacking most in our society today, and something that we'll talk a little bit about throughout the course of my remarks and Q&A, is that we don't debate the issues of the day as much as we could and should. As Max said, I'm not a native, but I lived here in Camden, graduated from Camden High School. Some of my classmates, I won't tell you what class, it's class of 58, and we're very darn proud of it, are here today, and I especially appreciate their attendance. Sometimes you feel you're getting along in years and when you can't remember things, and it's bothersome to me when I can't remember absolutely everything that I want to know or need to know. But I couldn't help but take heart when a couple in Syracuse in their 80s watching TV the other night, it was a commercial break, and the husband stood up and he said to his wife, "I'm going to the kitchen to get something to eat. Can I get you anything?" And she thought for a second. She said, "Yeah, I guess I wouldn't mind actually a bowl of vanilla ice cream, but write it down because you're going to forget it." He said, "No, I am not going to forget it. I got it. Is there anything else you want?" She said, "Well, now that you mention it, I wouldn't mind if you put some strawberries on the ice cream. But please, you've got to write that one down because you're going to forget both of them." He said, "I will not forget a thing that you've told me. Is there anything else that you want?" And she said, "If you could just put a little bit of whipped cream, that'll top it off very nicely. But that's three, and I know you're going to forget all three of them. So please, would you write them down?" He said, "I will get you exactly what you asked for." He went off to the kitchen. He was gone for 20 minutes. And he finally came back and handed her a dish of bacon and eggs. And she looked up at him and said, "You forgot the toast. I told you to write it down." Well, we're going to talk about some things today, and I hope that you don't forget many things that we're going to discuss, because I think it's important to talk about the world in which we live and where it's going and how we can think more strategically about it. We're all born and live for most of our lives during the bloodiest century in human history. Nearly half of the 20th century was spent fighting two world wars, fighting the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and a smattering of shorter conflicts like Grenada, Panama, the Gulf War, and the Balkans. And nearly half of it was consumed by squaring off against the Soviet Union in a Cold War. The preponderance of our foreign policy strategy was conflict or containment. Then, bless him, Mr. Gorbachev, seeking reform in his corrupt country, deprived us of one of those policy objectives when a challenge to his goals resulted ultimately in the disintegration of the last of the empires, as they were known. 20 years ago, this past December 25th, we entered a period we had not known in 45 years, unconditional peace, if we chose. But with that came a strategic disorientation. It was called, if you recall, the post-Cold War, and then the post-post-Cold War period. And that period was such because it was different because there was no enemy or enticing frontier to confront. What were we to do? We Americans are a romantic lot and sometimes dangerous. Filled with energy and drive, yet not sure whether to climb a mountain or head to the beach. At this point in our history, we didn't either. We floundered. We lost our strategic direction and balance. The object of any strategy is to concentrate a preponderance of influence or power at a decisive point in time. We had the power. We were the world's lone superpower, and we still are. We enjoyed that decisive moment of having won the Cold War when the spoils were ours to enjoy in a constructive way. Regrettably, we had no game plan for achieving goals available to us, nor the use of available resources and delivery systems to influence things for the better. Instead of shaping events going into this century, we let events shape us. The most defining event, of course, was 9/11, a day that will live forever in infamy. In response to the attack on America, the largest since Pearl Harbor, the George W. Bush administration chose to retaliate by invading Afghanistan and going after Al-Qaeda before they could do any more damage. A clear, coherent, and well-defined grand strategy of preemption. It was launched in October of 2001 in Afghanistan, and then again in March of 2003 in Iraq. Unfortunately, in my view, it was a flawed strategy, and its implementation led to more harm than benefit. Democracies come in various forms, and each has built-in strengths and weaknesses. Our democratic system has the vulnerability of changing leadership and potentially strategic direction every 4 or 8 years. Now, when Barack Obama took the presidential reins in 2009, hopes ran high that our grand strategy as a nation would move onto a more positive, peaceful path. Again, the unexpected intervened. Who would have anticipated the Arab Revolution of 2011? Clearly not the United States. As has been the case for the past 20 years, we fell victim to what I call STD, strategic thinking deficiency. Not a clue with what lieth ahead or how to maneuver in the face of the unexpected, which, oh, by the way, we could have anticipated better, in my view. Think about it. If a revolt by the principally young people of Iran could nearly be successful in the summer of 2009 to protest the rigged presidential elections there, why could not similar incidents occur in the Middle East? And they did. First in Tunisia in early 2011, and then in Egypt late last spring, and then the Libyans followed suit later in the year to bring down the third autocratic leader of a people in the Middle East last fall. Presidents Ben Ali of Tunisia, Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, and Muammar Gaddafi of Libya were felled while we looked on, for the most part. A chorus of foreign policy observers bemoaned the strategic incompetence of the United States. The real Obama doctrine is to have no doctrine at all, one analyst quipped. What I take away from what I have just described to you and the events of the past decade in particular is that we need to move in a new kind of strategic direction and have a new kind of strategic thinking, one that adapts to changing times and circumstances quicker, and one that anticipates what lies ahead better. Uncertainty itself is our contemporary adversary, and our strategy should be based on that premise. We must rely more heavily on an enduring inner logic that anticipates such things as failed states, failed transitions, societal collapse, massive migrations, and criminalized politics. Now, if those things sound abstract to you, let me put some names to those things. Places like Pakistan, North Korea, Libya, Somalia, and Mexico. With a laser-like focus, we must become more capable as a nation to apply strategic intensity to any situation, past, present, or future. We must bring our available resources, be they political, diplomatic, military, or economic, to bear on what I call the decisive point when they can and should be deployed to confront an objective or an adversary. The most immediate example in my mind is Iran. When will they, and should they, be allowed to possess a nuclear weapons capability? If not, how can we prevent that from happening? A question we have dealt poorly with for the past 10 years. Politically, no agreement on how to handle the problem. Economically, the sanctions we have imposed and encouraged other nations to apply have had some, but not sufficient, impact. Militarily, it would be a disaster to even think about using military force to halt or slow down their ambitions. Diplomatically, a disastrous approach, or actually non-existent approach, since 1979, when 52 Americans were taken hostage and held for 444 days when our embassy was seized there. Back to logic, which tells me in all four courses of action that I have just named, we have failed. Is it game over? Accept the inevitable? Well, the competitive spirit in me says no. Never, never say never. The Catholic heritage in me says try something with a Mother Teresa activism to it. The military background in me suggests that our Iran strategy should be about indirection, unexpected lines of attack, and avoiding the obvious courses of action. A less linear mode of thought, I believe, would recognize that authoritarian leaders like those of Iran create conflicts, like advancing their nuclear ambitions. Why? To live off of them, entrapping their own civilian societies and economies as hostage to conflict. Instead of allowing heavy-handed rulers like the Supreme Leader Khamenei and the corrupt President Ahmadinejad to live comfortably in the webs of repression they have woven, I'd abandon the isolation and containment policies we have chosen to no avail and try one of engagement. engagement with the people of their society who are dissatisfied with the life they have led of turmoil, an engagement with their neighbors dissatisfied with the conditions in the region that Iran has created. It may sound unorthodox, but I would bring linkages to the people of Iran, to the mainstream media, the internet, and the use of social media. Reach their intelligentsia, their civil society institutions, their scientists and their scholars, their diplomatic corps as well. These ideas all point toward the cardinal importance of conflict management, mediation, and creative interventions. Beat them at their own game by smothering them with strategic management, consisting of strategic thinking and strategic planning. They are not one and the same, by the way, but they both are essential in any thoughtful strategy-making process. Strategic thinking comes first and is done by connecting the past, present, and the future with the invention of creativity and ideas for moving forward in response to the what-ifs of life. Strategic planning converts these ideas into programmatic actions built upon analysis and design intent, the then what's of life. Examples, two. What if Kim Jong-il dies tomorrow? And what is our response? What if Iran seals off the Straits of Hormuz? And what is our response? Well, one actually happened, as you well know, when Kim Jong-il died, not as patiently as we thought he would. We gave him 2 years and he died not of cancer, but of a heart attack. Didn't know what to do. We weren't prepared for that. And what about the Straits of Hormuz, which Iran has offered to block and challenged us with the thought of doing so? Have we determined what we're going to do if that happens? The answer is no. Both techniques, strategic thinking and strategic planning, are necessary. And none is adequate without the other. It's a two-step process. Available to either is the use of power. What kind of power? Well, there's hard power, soft power, and smart power. What's hard power? Hard power is the use or not of military might. Soft power, what's that? It's the use of diplomatic initiative. Smart power, it is the use of intelligent opportunism. Regrettably, there has been an over-reliance thus far this century on hard power, almost to the exclusion of either soft or smart power. Our heavy-handed foreign policy has not endeared us to nations and peoples around the world who don't think kindly of us these days. We have lacked a credible grand strategy with respect to U.S. foreign policy, and that has not been a trivial matter for the U.S. as leader of the free world. A grand strategy is not especially esoteric. It is the calculated relationship of determining means to ends while addressing the what and the how of responding intelligently. A grand strategy is the collection of plans and policies that comprise a nation state's deliberate effort to harness political, military, economic, and diplomatic tools, and bringing them together to advance the state's vital national interest. It takes into consideration resources available, costs involved, potential consequences, risks and ramifications, and with that, those associated with our established objectives. The broadest objective of any such strategy is to make an honest appraisal of where the world is today, but what it's likely to look like tomorrow. What should be the attributes and characteristics of a good grand strategy? Well, there are five that come to my mind, and I'll share those with you. First of all, a grand strategy must be balanced to ensure that competing interests such as security, economics, and values are properly aligned. For example, if the preservation of U.S. security interests contributes to the erosion of America's economic base, then interests may need to be recalibrated. We can't afford another Iraq in Afghanistan to the tune of $1.4 trillion. Secondly, it must be prudent, so as to strike the correct balance between maintaining the United States' role as the global leader while ensuring that U.S. leadership does not face strategic exhaustion. Having been at war for more than 10 years on two different fronts, this nation is war-weary, which suggests that a more restrained application of U.S. power is in the U.S. national interest for the foreseeable future. Third, it must be principled, which is important for a nation built on certain unalienable rights. There must always be a role for American values, U.S. foreign policy, which leaders can point to and public opinion can support, is very important. Values have always been part of American exceptionalism, and that must continue to be so with everything we do or espouse. Fourth, it must be purposive, which is to say that it must advance positive principles while rejecting a we'll make it up as we go along approach to U.S. foreign policy. To advance America's interests and ideals, we must be seeing over the horizon, which means we must also articulate a positive vision for the future. And fifth, it must be sustainable in a way that it can endure over several administrations and is broadly supported by both the American people and over time as well. U.S. policymakers need a prioritized set of strategic ends and a pragmatic analytical process for matching the right means to those ends. Is this proposal for a grand strategy a fail-safe system? Will it operate without error or fault? Of course not. There are no guarantees that a planned and purposeful foreign policy strategy will be successful with respect to predictability and the necessary ends and means to meet the challenge. But it beats suffering from the strategic thinking deficiency that has plagued us for far too long. Helpful to this cause is the need to have a vigorous national debate like the one we're having today about the ends or the means or the exits available to us. That debate must occur not only in places like this forum, but in the halls of Congress and in the U.S. media as well. This is especially important at a time when the United States faces an unusually uncertain strategic environment and does so under real fiscal constraints. If I were king for a day, or president for a day, and I sought visionary help, here's my solution, or something that I think any president could use. Visionary help. I would assemble a strategic cell. Let's call it, for purposes of this discussion, an insight council. Not too large, a dozen or so led by an experienced thinker and doer, surrounded by a combination of talent, a historian, a diplomat, an economist, a military strategist, an anthropologist, a political scientist, a research specialist, a communicator, a hard scientist, a futurist, and other strategic means and minds as needed, with one common goal, to advise the president with insights past, present, and future so that he could have greater knowledge with which to make decisions on behalf of the nation and the people. Collectively, they would occupy a space near and have unfettered access to the president. And on the wall in the space where they worked would be a large hanging with these words from the preamble to the Constitution of the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, as it became known when formed in 1945. And that sign would say, since wars begin in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be constructed. Two people who come to mind and who embodied this philosophy are diplomat, historian George Kennan and President Dwight Eisenhower. Kennan authored our Cold War containment strategy, which he saw largely as a diplomatic and an economic approach to doing U.S. foreign policy. He argued, quote, "We must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose," unquote. Our 34th president was of the same mind. Eisenhower, in his very controversial farewell address, warned famously of the dangers to American liberty associated with an unrestrained military-industrial complex. Less famously, but no less perceptively, Ike warned of the danger to American prosperity and of, quote, "the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow," unquote. The United States can and should lead by the example of these bold men and their bright minds. Doing so can responsibly contribute to making the world a better place. This is a rare and unprecedented time in history, in my view. It holds unparalleled importance with respect to the opportunity to help bring stability, prosperity, and dignity to billions around the world by making strategically wise and prudent foreign policy decisions. And with that, I look forward to taking your questions.
Thanks, Bill. That's an incredibly thoughtful talk, and I see a whole bunch of hands going up. So you've obviously created a lot of questions. Let me start. Comment, please, on, this is the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu's recent quote, which was, "You are us and we are you." Isn't that the questioner says, a branding disaster to conflate our brand with Israel's?
The relationship between Israel and the United States is especially important. I would rank them as our closest ally, like it or not. And there are some people who don't like it. But it is the truth of the matter. And we are going to protect them, look out for them, and be beside them every step of the way. However, I'm concerned. I'm concerned with the relationship that has developed between us and Israel. And part of that is that the Prime Minister, Netanyahu, has flexed his muscles. One of the problems, as I alluded to in my talk, is that we don't have the same degree of power and influence when it comes to foreign policy as we have had in the past. So a lot of people don't listen to us anymore. People who have been our friends for decades no longer listen to us because they no longer believe that America has what it takes to lead the world. We need to change that. So Netanyahu has changed the equation with regard to some of his comments. I think we have to proceed very carefully. The situation with respect to what we're going to do or what Israel is going to do when it comes to Iran is one of the most critical conditions and possibilities that I can possibly imagine, as I said in my remarks, to attack Iran militarily would be a disaster. So I think what we need to do is we need to forge a stronger relationship with Israel, and the relationship that Obama has with Netanyahu is especially important. And we're not sure how the elections are going to come out, but it may be a new president in January of 2013, and then we're going to start the game all over again.
Okay, here's a slight follow-up to that, and that is, it relates to Iran. With all due respect, I think it is impossible, it's not conceivable, that we have no plan to respond to the closing of the Straits of Hormuz by Iran. How can you be so sure we don't?
There is military planning going on, without a doubt. We have sent some naval ships to the Straits to show that we are present and accounted for. Yes, there is a plan in the sense that we could bring them under attack. But with a few speedboats and a few machine guns, they can create more havoc with our warships than you want to imagine. This is not going to be the conventional type of situation if Iran chooses to indeed create a problem for U.S. naval presence. I don't think it will happen. Why? Because it has played out in the press sufficiently that it would not be to their advantage. But having a real plan that is going to work under any circumstance, you're kidding yourself if you think that we can do it in a way that is not going to cause a problem regionally and light a fire which we're not going to be able to control to the degree that I think we would want to under any circumstance.
We'll come back in a moment to more specific questions about specific countries, but let me, this is sort of a two-part question. One is, the first part, what do you think is the greatest obstacle to President Obama or any president implementing your plan? And a related question is, have you had any opportunity to communicate your grand strategy to President Obama?
The answer to two is no. I'm no longer on the call list with the White House. I used to have a call every morning when I was Chief of Staff at the State Department. The White House would call all of the Chiefs of Staff, and we would have a pleasant conversation with regard to what the President was going to do that day and sort of the things that we stood for and some of the messaging that would go on. So I have not conveyed my grand strategy. The problem is that President Obama does not have that cell that I suggested. He doesn't have the thinkers and the doers that he should surround himself with. He's on his third chief of staff. He'll have a fourth before it's over. When you change chiefs of staff as often as that, you've got no direction in which you are going to go with assurance and with confidence. And so what I think he has lacked are the thinkers and the doers, some of which I mention in my strategic cell. If I were president for a day, the very first person I would hire is a historian. Why would I want a historian? Well, we Americans, first of all, don't pay much attention to history. Shame on us. We're too young a nation to really recognize that history is one of the sole guidance systems that we should pay attention to. That historian would sit in the very next office to me, and I would have him or her come in several times a day to tell me the relationship between what lies ahead and what has happened in the past. He hasn't had that kind of thinking, and I think that is a failure of his system. So I'm going to hope that if he gets reelected, he does it differently, and I'm going to hope that if somebody else is elected, that he is also going to do it in a different form. You've got to have the ability to turn to the brightest minds that are available to you and seek the thinking and the wisdom and the guidance and the recommendations of people who have been there, done that, and can help you think through a tough situation that lies before you.
Okay, here's a sort of indirect follow-up to the last question and to your answer. Do you think Obama's lack of foreign policy experience is part of the problem? And broadening that out, it seems that the people who end up getting elected president very seldom have much foreign policy experience.
Well, I do think he had virtually no foreign policy experience when he took the reins. Now, he has had some successes taking down Osama bin Laden was not a trivial matter. 1st of May last year, that was a big deal, and it resulted in a house of cards that has begun to fall, and I think will continue to fall. I think we've killed a lot of Al-Qaeda leaders. He Obama has ordered more drone strikes on targets of what I would call high importance. People who are at the top of the list of Al-Qaeda operatives, and we have clearly killed many of them. So he's had some strategic successes, and I think, quite frankly, he gets probably criticized more strongly than he should in that regard, but he does need more people around him to help him wander through these shoals with regard to Iran, what are we going to do one way or another with regards to North Korea? He's going to lose some very important cabinet officials. My guess is that Secretary Clinton is going to step down probably next January, and she's not going to run for vice president. For those who think she ought to, you're probably going to be disappointed. I think she's tired. And the sort of the rule of thumb is go as long as you have gas in the tank. And I think the gas in her tank is she's running on fumes right now, so I think she's going to move on. When you lose a Secretary of State, you've got to build relationships with all of those partners around the world, with all of those adversaries around the world that you're going to sit across the table with. And to use as an example, when she started out, she made a huge mistake. Why? Because she started appointing envoys to the Middle East, envoys to North Korea, envoys to Pakistan. Madam Secretary, that's your job. You ought to be going to those places and talking to those countries. You are the appointed representative of the president. And when you send somebody else, like anything in life, the old parlor game we used to play as children where you start a rumor and it goes around the circle. If you're sitting across from an envoy, a representative of the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense, you're not going to tell, if you're the adversary, that individual everything you would or should the Secretary of State or Defense. Why? Because, first of all, you can assume that some of it's going to get poorly translated. Some of it may even be misrepresented with the biases that the person who's sitting across from you may have with regard to what that is doing. So we're going to have a new set of probably players. I'm not sure Secretary Panetta is going to go quite as quickly as Secretary Clinton, but that starts a whole new mining responsibility for our cabinet.
This may put you a little bit on the spot, but we've been discussing President Obama, so let's talk about the Republicans. In your opinion, do any of the Republican candidates for president, or at least the top three, the three remaining ones, have a vision for, quote, a grand strategy?
I know Governor Romney personally. I think he, first of all, if you were to walk into this room, he would light it up. He's got a great deal of charisma. He's got some incredible business experiences, the Olympic experience that he has. He knows how to take a situation that needs help, and he knows how to manage it. So I think, first of all, he's going to win the nomination. I think he is going to be the person that will go head-to-head with President Obama. And I think of the three, he's probably in the sense of making decisions, the one that I would probably put my reliance on. But once again, it would greatly depend upon who he surrounds himself with. And as some of you know, when a new administration, even when an administration is going around for a second term and you have to find new people, the appointment process takes far too long. When we went to the State Department in January of 2001, Secretary Powell and I had sat down. We came up with a list of people that we wanted in selected positions, starting with the deputy secretary and then the undersecretaries and then the deputy secretaries, and it goes down the line. To take the congressional process full scale, it takes 6 to 9 months before you get all of those appointed people in places that they are going to occupy for the remainder of the term that president is in office. So I think Romney is going to be stuck with that challenge. I think Obama, is going to lose some of his cabinet officials, and he's going to have to get some new ones. Every new one gets new deputies, gets new undersecretaries and assistant secretaries, and so there's going to be a new team on the court in many respects, however it turns out. But I think Romney's probably got the best chance, and I think he, I'm not doing politics here now, I'm just giving an honest answer to the question. I think he could do a reasonable job if he were elected president. And I think Obama's got to do a better job if reelected president.
Okay, I'm going to start with this question was a very broad one and then narrow it down. The broad one is, do you believe in American exceptionalism? The narrower focus on this it's a separate question. You speak as if you believe that the world is America's responsibility. Do you really believe that? Why is it?
Well, it starts with being the only superpower. If you are the only superpower, if you have the best military in the world, we do. If you have the strongest economy in the world, we do. That, unfortunately, leads to some responsibilities with regard to perhaps the use of force or perhaps the distribution of some resources. I do think we as a people believe that we are perhaps a bit different. And that's based on our history. The shining city on the hill, as Reagan actually stole the quote, once said. And I think we see ourselves that way. So I think we are unique. And I do think we have some responsibilities. And I do think for the most part, the world is still looking to us to lead them to a better place. They certainly were looking for it in 2001 when Bush came to office. And that obviously went awry with the events of 9/11. I think they were looking to Obama. And he gave one of his first major talks was in Cairo. He was trying to create a different relationship with the nations in the Middle East, and unfortunately that unraveled with the Arab Revolution of 2011. I do think we have a responsibility. If you want to resort to isolationism, I'm sorry. First of all, it's not going to happen. If you think that we should not take responsibility for things in the world in which we live, I just disagree. I think we have a responsibility. I think we have to use intelligence and strategic relevance when it comes to handling those responsibilities. But like it or not, I think we're going to continue down that road. And I think what we need to do is we need to restore the attitudes and the opinions of peoples around the world towards the United States so that we can lead. We can make the world a better place if we lead it to a better place, and I think we have the capability of doing that. And I think if we were to walk away from that responsibility, it would be a shame.
Okay, we're going to switch this up to some specific countries. We've been unsuccessful in engaging either Russia or China to help deal with serious issues, specifically in Syria, Iran. Why? What do you think we can do to get their cooperation?
Well, we're going to have a new leader in China later this year. We're going to have, of course, we now have a new president in Russia. I think we're going to have problems with Russia. I think President Putin, he is not the greatest fan of America. He's going to make life very difficult for us. He is going to put obstacles in our way with everything we care to do. Why? Because it's the imperialism, the empire spirit that he wants to regenerate amongst his own people. Unfortunately, his people are beginning to take exception to some of the things that he stands for. So with a new leader in Russia, I think it's going to be increasingly difficult. With a new leader in China, I think we have the potential for creating a stronger relationship. And that person recently visited the United States for several days, and quite frankly, I was impressed with what he said and what he did. Unfortunately, what we tend to do with so many people is we tend to lecture them. We gave him a lot of lectures, things that he ought to know before he becomes the next president of China. And I think we've got to get over that habit. It's a bad one. We did it when Russia disintegrated, when the Soviet Union disintegrated. We tried to tell Russia everything that they needed to do to become a strong nation again. And quite frankly, it resulted in a great deal of resentment, and Putin is going to make us, probably suffer the result of his attitude towards us. The reason that we have difficulty with Russia and China when it comes to Syria is that they have a relationship with Syria, both militarily and diplomatically and economically, all the things that we ought to be forging relationships with. And if all of those things count in the case of China and Russia with respect to Syria, they're not going to do anything that is going to make the Syrians uncomfortable with Assad uncomfortable with what he does. Unfortunately for Assad, I don't think that's going to last very, very long. I think his days are numbered.
I hope you're right on that. We've got a question that relates to two, one active, one ex-military guys who spoke at the Camden Conference, Mickleby and Porter. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, Bill. Their national strategic narrative calls for us to move from a strategy of containment, this is on China, to one of building legitimate influence. Aren't we stuck in containment, at least with respect to China? And to tie in another question about China, how effective do you think China's use of smart power, soft power, has been? And do you think it's going to morph into hard power?
I don't think it's going to morph into hard power. Yes, the Chinese are building a capability which is causing its neighbors in that region to be very uncomfortable, and they're trying to build up their military capability in response to that, because you've got to maintain a balance. If you live in the neighborhood, you've got to have the same kind of green grass as everybody. You've got to have the same kind of painted house as everybody, and that's true when nations have to live with one another. China has its first aircraft carrier. We seem to be concerned about that. We've got 17 of them. I don't know why we're so worried about that. They've got their first stealth fighter. We've got hundreds of them. I'm not sure why we're so worried about that. They do have their first anti-ship ballistic missile, something we don't yet have. So they are building their military capability fairly quickly. They're buying things in large numbers. They have a huge standing military, and they've got more toys than anybody else in the neighborhood, which is why Japan, Australia, and Singapore, and all of the other nations in that part of the world are trying to buy up South Korea, trying to buy up everything that they possibly can to keep pace with them. With regard to soft power, China has been absolutely brilliant at trying to do that in places that we haven't even scratched the surface. And the continent of Africa is a place that they have dug a lot of nests for themselves, economic nests, diplomatic nests, and we, quite frankly, can't even find a place that will assume responsibility for an African command that the United States wants to create. It's still headquartered in Germany, and it's probably going to stay there, even though it has some military strategic responsibilities for the continent of Africa. So China is moving very, very quickly to create as many opportunities. And I've read the report of the national strategic narrative that the two presenters gave. I think, by and large, they were correct with their views with respect to China. Make no mistake about it. China is growing economically at a rate that we kind of gasp at. All of the economists who are experts predict that it will become the leading economy in the world by the year 2027, if not before. Once again, to where we are going to be with respect to a global power or leader, if you lose the first place in anything, you are simply not going to have the stature. You're not going to have the respectability that perhaps is required when you're trying to convince other people to do certain things, as we are with Russia and China with respect to Syria. If you can't influence their thinking because you've lost some gravitas, then it's going to be a tough thing. I'm glad you had these two folks here, and they've written a great report, and I commend the conference for having them.
This is also something of a follow-up. You referred to the United States in the context of our exceptionalism as, after all, the world's only superpower. What you were just saying shows that we're not going to be forever the world's only superpower. The questioner asks, is there a middle ground between exceptionalism and isolationism? How can we encourage other nations to share in the responsibility, the global responsibility that we've taken on ourselves over the last two decades?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I think what you have to do is forge relationships that are more than superficial. And what we have to do in every part of the world is make sure that we have that dialogue that is available to us. Sitting in the State Department post 9/11, I must tell you, it was an opportunity lost. Why? Because the exceptionalism that we have as part of our brand, we have a brand as a nation, and that's part of our brand, is what we stand for. That's what got us to where we are in the world today. People flocked to Washington, presidents, kings, foreign ministers, defense ministers. They came in droves to do what? To meet with the president, to meet with the secretary of defense, to meet with the secretary of state. And I sat in on all of those meetings, those bilateral meetings, with Secretary Powell and all of those world leaders. And what were they here for? They were here to say, America, first of all, we express our condolences. Secondly, we support you. Thirdly, we offer help in any way, shape, or form. And what did we do? We said, no, thank you. We can do it just fine by ourselves. And we did, for all intents and purposes, in Afghanistan. Sure, other countries eventually joined us, but we blew through there, knocked Al-Qaeda out of the saddle, and they went off to the mountains of Afghanistan and in Pakistan. And then all of that support drained away when we invaded Iraq in March of 2003. A terrible mistake. And you'll never convince me that had we done it differently, that we would be that we would not be in a better place today with respect to our brand, with respect to our reputation, with respect to our ability to sit across the table from an ally or an adversary and speak to them in ways that will influence their thinking with regard to the relationship that they want to have with the United States.
This has been a fascinating discussion, and we're going to end it with one final question that sort of gives you the opportunity to bring it all together. It's about a specific country. If we had a more coherent strategy along the lines that you're talking about towards Pakistan, for example, what would we be doing differently?
There is not a country on the face of the earth that scares me more than Pakistan. This is a dangerous country, a fragile government, a military that has enormous capability, and I'm not sure that they care about their relationship with the United States. So if I were concerned with any country, I would invest more in our relationship with Pakistan than probably any other place on the face of the earth. We have got to do a better job. Unfortunately, the incident where we killed 24 Pakistani soldiers because of a military miscue, we thought the target was an enemy target. It happened to be a Pakistani military target, and we hit them with an airstrike and a drone strike, and we killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. They have just begun to forgive us. They are just allowing us to fly drones again in Pakistan, and we've got to fly a lot of drones. Why? Because it's the greatest sanctuary for terrorists on the face of the earth. There are more terrorists or people who have untoward desire to create havoc residing in Pakistan than any other place on the face of the earth. We need to change that. And if we just allow the Pakistanis to do what the Pakistanis don't want to do, which is to take care of business, I think we stand the vulnerability of another attack on America. I think we've done an awful lot of things to preclude that from happening, but I will just say, and everyone from the CIA to the DIA to the Defense Department reminds us it only takes one small vulnerability that we haven't looked at closely enough, and we're going to be vulnerable again. And quite honestly, I think we've got to pay attention to those, to routing out those kinds of bad guys that reside in Pakistan. So I would invest heavily. If I were the Secretary of State, we've got a great envoy. Once again, we're back to envoys. Mark Grossman, who was Undersecretary when we were in the State Department, is the envoy to Pakistan. He's trying very hard, but sometimes they won't even let him in the country because they don't want to talk to him. And we've got to fix that. So I think what we need to do is obviously spend some time doing that as much in Washington as in Islamabad. And I think we got to work hard at making the world a better place, and the relationship with Pakistan can make that better for us. I want to thank you very much for having me today. I hope this has been helpful to you. It's certainly been fun for me. Great to be back. I don't think there's a better view in the whole world than the one looking out this window. So thank you very much. Thank you
very much. Hey, terrific. And-